For the Germanic tribes, meat was the central element in the diet, rather than bread and grain. They didn't even really have a major staple grain crop. Instead of wine, of course, they drink cider from fermented apples, mead made from honey, we think of like Beowulf and the Mead Hall, or beer, of course, which is what they grow their barley for.
Welcome back to Food, a Cultural Culinary History, a podcast brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. I'm Jason Smigel, and like you, I'm a lifelong learner. I've been listening to The Great Courses for over 14 years, and I'm excited to be sharing this great course as a podcast with you. This podcast is hosted by Ken Albala, who's professor of history and chair of food studies at the University of the Pacific. He's also the author of Ken Albala's Food Rant, a highly popular blog for people who love food. Episode 11, Europe's Dark Ages and Charlemagne. The fall of Rome and the rise of Germanic tribal kingdoms brought significant culinary changes to Europe. In this podcast, we're going to examine the barbarian diet and the culture of fast and feast, which emerged from opposing ideals of Christian asceticism, German meat-eating virility, and classical moderation. Then we'll look at Charlemagne's dynamic rule and his important impact on food culture. As always, if you're interested in trying any of Ken's recipes and food experiments, or even seeing photos and illustrations of the concepts that Ken mentions in this podcast, you can find supporting materials for this podcast at thegreatcoursesdaily.com.
The word Dark Ages has fallen out of favor with most historians, or at least its use has been restricted to a much more narrow chronological period, spanning roughly from about the 450s to 800 at the time of Charlemagne. The word, of course, only applies to Western Europe. You know, in the eastern half of the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, classical culture was still flourishing, and the trade networks to the east were largely maintained. So that label, Dark Ages, really doesn't apply at all. But I'm going to use Dark Ages for the entire early Middle Ages of Western Europe, from about the fall of Rome to about the year 1000. Because apart from a few brief flurries of learning, like in the Carolingian court, Western Europe is pretty bleak. I mean, economically, agriculturally, scientifically, in most endeavors, including cuisine and food culture, this period is pretty dark. As you probably know, the Roman Empire was showing signs of internal weakness long before 410. I mean, that's when the barbarian armies, the Visigoths under Alaric, actually sacked the city. Roman weakness was due to many complex factors, but in a nutshell, it had mostly to do with overextending the empire and using barbarian tribes along the frontier to protect Roman territory. And that meant that they learned Roman fighting tactics and military technology, and they could eventually use it against the Romans themselves. These barbaric tribes also became Romanized in a sense. They'd been trading cattle with the Romans for years. And when these semi-barbarians on the edges themselves were threatened from the outside by other invaders, such as the Huns, it made perfect sense for them to turn to Rome for help, which was actually denied them. And being basically forced into Roman soil, they kind of liked what they found there, and they decided to take it, which, you know, created a moment of extreme weakness, during which other tribes basically just came pouring in. So how all this happened isn't really central to our story, but just realize that the entire Western Roman Empire was subsumed by Germanic tribes, who were basically in a state of culture comparable to those other warrior pastoralists that we've been discussing, you know, the Arians, the Shang, the Mycenaeans. But now we're 2,000 years later, and these Germanic tribes, well, they're not nomadic anymore, but they did practice agriculture. Still, their cultural values of strength, courage, success in battle, above anything else, they really have few other moral standards, at least while they remain pagan. So who were these tribes? They're the Goths, who are divided into two groups, the Visigoths, meaning literally Western Goths, who eventually settle in Spain, the Ostrogoths, or Eastern Goths, who come into Italy for a while. The Vandals in northern Africa, of course, came with spray paint cans, right? Get the word Vandal from them, actually. The Franks, who eventually carve out a kingdom over what is today France and Germany. There are also the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes and Frisians. They invaded Britain. And then latecomers, the Lombards, go into northern Italy. And all these tribes, they kind of mixed with the earlier Roman populations in the province, who were themselves of mixed blood, you know, Romano-Celtic or Romano-British or whatever. So in terms of blood and ethnicity, as well as culture, we'll see Germanic is mixed with these Roman Christians. These new tribes also had kings. But as far as any consistent control over the countryside goes, they were very haphazard administrations. And for all practical purposes, there was near anarchy in much of Europe. Anyone who had weapons basically had to fend for themselves. And in fact, the smartest thing to do would be to have your own private army or band of marauders if you're seeking booty. So as the infrastructure of the empire fell apart, so too did trade. You know, agriculture and the whole marketing system, barter eventually replaces money, and the entire economy shrinks back to a completely local subsistence level. The 5th century AD was also a period of widespread famine. A major plague struck, let alone all these marauders. So there's a remarkable decline in the population. Now, don't get the idea that there was consistent famine for centuries, but when a crop failure hit, there was absolutely no backup. There's no grain reserves kept by the state. There's no trade to supply from other parts of the region, other parts of the empire or Europe. So Gregory of Tours, writing in the late 6th century, said that people used grape seeds or fern roots to make bread. They began to eat weeds and grasses from the field, which eventually made them sick and swollen during one famine. Procopius, also writing in the 6th century, during the time of Justinian's attempt to take back Rome, tells us of people in Italy desperately shoving any clump of grass or dirt into their mouths to fill their stomachs, and eventually dying in the streets. He also mentions that people eventually turned to cannibalism out of desperation. So even apart from scenes like this, gruesome as they are, people had to become more resourceful at finding food in the forests and in the swamps. And there's a dramatic increase in the number of wild species of plants and animals consumed, especially as the countryside becomes deserted. People move on to the best land to cultivate. They begin to abandon the hillsides and the more difficult terrain, most of which actually returns to wilderness. And in every way that the Greeks and Romans valued civilized cities surrounded by miles of well-tilled farms and orchards of grapes and olive groves and wheat neatly arranged and stockyards, the barbarians are the opposite. They value the wild forest, hunting, fishing, gathering wild fruits, and letting their herds of pigs forage for themselves in the forest on acorns or beech nuts. They even measured land not by distance, but by the number of pigs that could forage in a given space. There was also this notion in Germanic mythology that the forests were sacred places inhabited by all sorts of spirits, elves, fairies, but even the trees themselves were prayed to. There are also sacred springs and mountains, and there's a real kind of affection for nature as a divine thing, which is largely absent from Greco-Roman society. They also, of course, hunted in these woods. But above all else, for the Germanic tribes, meat was the central element in the diet, rather than bread and grain. They didn't even really have a major staple grain crop. Instead of wine, of course, they drink cider from fermented apples, mead made from honey, we think of like Beowulf and the Mead Hall, or beer, of course, which is what they grow their barley for. And drinking beer was not just a matter of refreshment or relaxation. It's the central social ritual among these Germans, competitive drinking even, as a sign of virility. And they would drink out of these elaborate carved, horns that you couldn't actually put it down. So you basically had to drink the whole thing. And they also drank curdled milk. Other major differences, instead of olive oil, they used butter from their cattle or lard. And in fact, they even used rancid butter in their hair as a pomade, So, and that has a lot to do, of course, with geography and climate, but it's also a major cultural difference. And there was a perception among early medieval writers that the barbarians not only ate more wild food, but they ate more uncooked raw meat, uncooked foods, or things that were rough and difficult to digest, like turnips and leeks. And so if cooking is a kind of trope for civilization, then rawness and roughness is equated with barbarity. And I mean, think of the you know, the Scythians or the Tartars who ate raw meat and drank the blood of their cattle. The Germans aren't quite that extreme, but they still prefer fresh flesh over anything else. So as an example of this emphasis placed on meat, there's an interesting book. It's called De Observatione Ciborum. It's a dietary regimen written by this physician named Anthimus. He was actually Greek, so he's trained in Galenic medicine, but he was hired by the Ostrogothic king in Ravenna and then sent as a kind of ambassador or guest physician all the way over to the Franks. And he wrote this diet book while there, and it places an enormous emphasis on pork. I mean, things like how to roast it, how to boil it, how to stew or bake it, how to cook with lard, the best way to cook bacon. I mean, it's clear that this is what his patrons were most interested in learning about, and he had to kind of adapt his ideas to suit these people. For example, he tells us, the fresher the pork is, the lighter and more digestible it is. Loin of pork is best eaten roasted because it is a good food and well digested, providing that while roasting, it is brushed with a feather, dipped in brine. And he says, suckling pig is extremely good and agreeable when boiled or cooked in a sauce, as well as roasted in an oven, provided the heat is not too great and that it's not burnt too much, but instead prepared so that it becomes like steamed meat. It can then be dipped into a simple honey and vinegar mixture. The meat is dipped into the sauce while eaten. That's all a big quote. So what do you notice is different here? Just a few hundred years after Apicius. I mean, they still like sweet and sour flavors, right? I mean, he was talking basically about a barbecue sauce, right? But there are no spices, right? Those are now unavailable. Those spice roots have largely been cut off. Or at least spices have become such a rarity that no author could expect his readers to find them. And the preparation is pretty simple and straightforward, right? They do still have oven technology, but it seems like the closer to the outdoors, the more the Franks would like it, especially, you know, charred, smoky barbecue. And think for a moment what that really means, barbecue. I would think of what it conjures up for Americans, right? It's manliness, it's virility. It's one of the few foods men are prepared to cook, right? So here's another snippet. As for bacon, which, so I hear, the Franks have a habit of eating, I am full of curiosity regarding the person who showed them such a medicine as to obviate the need for other medicines. They eat it raw because it's very beneficial and as a remedy is responsible for their health. Now here, I'm not sure he means bacon in our sense of the word, like a cured pork belly, but I think he's thinking of a kind of cured raw ham, something closer to prosciutto. But the most interesting part is this has nothing to do with Greek medicine. He's adapting his ideas for them. And he even says at one point that beer and mead are health-promoting drinks. That's not what most Greek theorists would say. Clearly, he's trying to please the Franks and get a job with them, I assume. Now, as I mentioned, these Germanic tribes were also eventually converted to Christianity. But in the process of conversion, they didn't totally wipe out their former practices. In fact, they were often kind of assimilated or accommodated, meaning that older rituals would be given a Christian twist. A good example of this is how these two cultures mixed are the names for our days of the week. Think, you know, they're actually Roman and German pagan mixed. Think of Wotan's Day, Thor's Day, Freya's Day, versus the Roman ones, Saturn Day, Sunday, Moon Day, right? And our months are even a little weirder because New Year's used to begin on March 25th, which is why September would be the 7th month, October the 8th month, November the 9th, December the 10th, right? Anyway, we've changed it.
If you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, the new audio and video streaming site from The Great Courses, the leader in lifelong learning. Featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from great battles of history, organic chemistry, Buddhism, word etymology, algebra, sacred music, and a whole lot more. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.
Well, the point about Christianity is that grain, wine, and oil had to be grown for sacramental purposes. And it was usually the monasteries that maintained vineyards left over from classical times. Remember, they're little communal refuges in a very disordered world. And they're just about the only place that learning of any kind is taking place. Much of what they did was just copying whatever text they could find. In fact, the two surviving copies of Apicius made it Fulda in the 9th century, a great example of that. They also tended medicinal herb gardens, prepared simples or medicines, and they're the only people preserving even the last shreds of classical medicine, which has now been mixed with Germanic folk recipes and such. And monks are also among the very few people who still know how to graft fruit trees and cultivate wine grapes. The culture of wine did not replace that of beer overnight, especially because the Germans used beer as a sacrifice. And there's a very funny, kind of revealing story of St. Columban, who's the missionary among the Swabians. And he goes there and he finds them with this huge tub full of beer, which he estimated to be 180 liters or something like that. And he finds out that they're going to sacrifice this to Wotan. And he blows on the big cask and smashes it to 1,000 pieces. They see this devil fly out of the cask of beer. Obviously, this is sort of propaganda. But I think the Christians really had a hard time getting these newly converted Germans to give up their eating, and in this case, drinking habits as well. And this will be, in fact, the case. And in fact, it's a sticking point, and we'll see when we get to the 16th century, when they institute a compulsory fast for Lent. Now, what does that mean? It's no animal or dairy products for a long period, 40 days. And it's actually widely repeated that the Pope at the time who started this came from a family of fishermen. And so this was a way to promote business. No meat, you have to eat fish. I don't think that story is true. But it is true that the early Christians really only had voluntary fasts. You do this when you decided you needed to appease God. But by this time, a universal prohibition of meat and meat products was in place. And it's interesting because the apostles, remember, they fasted on Friday to commemorate the death of Jesus on that day. But there really weren't any universal fasting periods across all of Christendom. Those things come in the 4th century, after Emperor Constantine adopted Christianity. And the fast days, there can actually be a lot of them. I mean, you know, up to 150 in a year. Now, what's interesting is that they're not really that burdensome for Southern European Christians, because they can eat vegetables and fish, and those are staples of the diet, nothing odd. But what of the Germans, way up in the north? They're told abstain from butter, milk, and pork, and use oil instead for 40 days, from Ash Wednesday all the way to Easter. Now, they can't grow oil there, so it has to be imported. And not only was that culturally burdensome, but economically, right? The time of year that's the hardest to survive in February and March, you can't eat all your hams and sausages that you've been storing, just sauerkraut, pickled fish, and a whole lot of beans. Beans become central to the diet for Lent. The idea of Lent, the Friday fast, or Saturday and Wednesday in some places, and all the other fast days meant that the whole idea of moderation, a balanced diet, seasonal adjustment according to the weather and exercise, right? I mean, that what we saw among the Greco-Roman culture, that gives way to a culture of fast and feast. Periods of want set by the church contrasted with periods of sometimes gross overindulgence, such as carnival, and various feast days throughout the calendar. And remember, the whole idea of competitive feasting, that's already built into Germanic society. Warriors not only boast how strong and fierce they are, and how many men they can kill, but also how much meat they can consume. And even the Norse gods, you know, they were always out trying to outfeast each other. And I think at the court of Charlemagne, the emperor at one point has some guests over, and one of these guys picks up a huge hunk of meat, devours it, cracks open the bones, sucks out the marrow. I mean, there's no contemporary manners here, you know? And Charlemagne guesses, this must be the son of the king of the Lombards, because only a noble warrior could eat like that. And Charlemagne says, this guy must be a heartily strong soldier. So what we have are basically two or three opposed ideals, right? There's this quasi-ascetic Christian ideal. There's the meat-eating virility of the Germanic barbecues, right? And then there's this classical idea of moderation and paying attention to health and the seasons. And all of these become an integral part of the culture, right? You fast for Lent, There's heroic feasting just before it, during Carnival, Meat Day, Fat Tuesday, right? I'll come to that in much greater detail when we get to the High Middle Ages, when the celebrations become an enormous ritual. But just realize that the fast and feast mentality is introduced here among the Germanic Christian kingdoms, and it extends down the social hierarchy as well. I mean, this idea that you stuff yourself whenever you can because tomorrow there may not be food, right? So from the bottom right up to the top, Charlemagne himself is interesting in this regard because he was supposed to be, you know, he's a Germanic king, so he's got to be virile. By all accounts, he loved his roast meat. But, you know, he's also a Christian, and that, you know, promoting austerity and later emperor of the Romans, who, you know, he was supposed to value moderation. And his biographer, who's Einhard, has a really time reconciling all these three in his description of Charlemagne's eating habits, because he really can't, you know, but this is a culture that is the product really of all three traditions. And you might even say, in a way, our own conflicting attitudes toward food might even have their roots in these early medieval dilemmas. We have different voices going on in our heads, the dieting, you know, the moderation, and then the feasting. So another feature of this mix of cultures is wheat cultivation, which was maintained where it was feasible, obviously Southern Europe, Italy, and Spain. But beyond that, really only the wealthiest of people can afford it. And while bread becomes a kind of status symbol, you know, along with drinking wine. But the rest of the Germanic populace ate rye, which is practically unknown to the Romans, but it thrives in the colder northern climate. And rye alone, or sometimes they'll mix it with spelt, it makes a kind of dark, dense bread. And it doesn't contain as many glutens, so it doesn't rise quite the same way wheat flour does. But the point is that from this time on, the color of bread will be a matter of social distinction. You know, it's odd how in many cultures, white bread means refined in a very positive sense. But those values sometimes turn upside down. If you think of, say, the 60s and 70s, or maybe even now, unrefined brown bread is seen as more natural and it takes precedence. And somehow, you know, the Wonder Bread is less valued. So another interesting thing about rye is sometimes it is infected with a fungus called ergot. An ergotism is a disease at the time called St. Anthony's Fire. And this causes hallucinations, mass hysteria, a kind of burning sensation in the skin. And the reason this happens is that the active compound in the fungus, it's lysergic acid. So it's very close chemically to LSD. And the reason people didn't notice this is in the grain, it's very hard to detect because it just sort of looks like a brown grain. There's nothing strange about the way it looks. But in any case, there are outbreaks of this numerous after 857. And I think the last outbreak must be in the 1950s in France. So it's a serious, it makes dark rye something suspect among the elites. They don't really want to eat rye bread out of this danger. So let me tell you a little more about Charlemagne while we're in the 800s. He's really the most interesting ruler of the early Middle Ages. And let me begin by saying that the Franks kind of emerge as the dominant tribe and eventually a kingdom and then finally an empire for various reasons. Among the most important is that most of the other Germanic kingdoms collapsed. The Visigoths in Spain, they're conquered by the Moors in 700s. The Ostrogoths fell to the Byzantines and then so did the Lombards. Byzantines also destroyed the Vandals. And then the Angles and Saxons, they started in northern Germany, but they move into Britain and they divide up into very small kingdoms. So only the Franks build a large state. And that's beginning with Clovis in the late 400s, and the Merovingian dynasty descended from him. And the system of rule they initiated, I'm going to start mentioning it here because it's the ancestor of feudalism, with lots of semi-independent dukedoms that own fealty, as well as counties. In fact, we get our word count from Charlemagne's system of rule. And rather than these large slave-run latifundia that proliferated in Roman times, the model that emerges here is called serfdom. Rather small holdings, farmed by people who are legally bound to the soil. They're not slaves, they can't be bought and sold, but they have to stay where they are, and they have to work a certain specified number of days on their lord's demesne. That means his own personal property. There are also various kinds of taxes they have to pay. There's a tax for inheritance, a tax if they want to get married, a tax for wardship if someone is underage and can't run the plot themselves. And all of these fees have to be paid to the lord. There may be fees for using the bakehouse or the wine press. And realize that for all practical purposes, the lord of the manor is virtual ruler in his own realm. He has his own private army, in fact, and only the king has direct authority over him. The king can ask that he come and fight with him, but there's not much else that he can do. And of course, most nobles do fight with the king because it means great profit and favor and so forth. So Charles the Great, let's get back to him, was a grim and merciless warrior, but interestingly, also a patron of the arts and learning. And he used the spoils of war to found a court to which he invited the best theologians and scholars from all around Europe. He founded schools and monasteries like the ones at Fulda and St. Gall. And it was in these monasteries that they began to copy classical texts, really for the first time in maybe 400 years or so, such that scholars now call this a kind of Carolingian Renaissance. Let me give you an example. They invented the Carolingian minuscule, the lowercase letters and the spacing of the between words we now take for granted. All of that is an invention of this era. But Charlemagne also had this fondness for Roman society and Roman style and of rule, and that prompted him to go to Rome to be crowned by the Pope as emperor in the year 800. And for the history of food, Charlemagne is very important because he issued orders to his leading vassals to plant various foods throughout his empire, presumably so that he could be supplied on his campaign when he came through. A really fascinating text called the Capitularies. Certain vegetables were, in fact, directly reintroduced to Europe through his sponsorship, as well as fruits that are harder to maintain, things that take time. Let me read you a little snippet of this. Let there be apple trees, pear trees, plums, cherries, walnuts, chestnuts, etc. He also sponsored setting up fish ponds so they could be stocked with fish like carp and trout, and ordered that all his farms keep 100 hens and 30 geese so they could have fresh eggs when they arrived on their campaigns. He also, according to one of his chroniclers, discovered, a monastery near a little town called Roquefort that was making this interesting blue vein cheese. And he ordered several rounds to be sent to his palace at Aachen, or at least this is what the claim of the people at Roquefort. Charlemagne also tried to regulate the food trades. There's a law, for example, of 793 that said one denier would be worth 12 wheat breads weighing exactly 2 pounds, or 15 rye breads, or 20 barley breads, or 25 oat. And you can see that there's a very clear hierarchy of grains, right? Oats are interesting. They're actually a medieval invention. They really weren't eaten before, and they're probably domesticated right about this time. We also know a bit about Charlemagne's eating habits. We know he hated his doctors because they told him not to eat that roast meat he loved so much. We know that he customarily had 4 courses in a meal, as well as these roasts, which hunters brought him on longer, these long spits. And remember, there's actually still a lot of fuel to burn in the north. There's wood everywhere. And we also know that they use these big cauldrons to boil food. And the assumption is that this is really pretty simple fare that they're eating. Boiled pulses, beans, grains, bread, maybe some wine from the south. Beer obviously has to be there. Some stews and vegetables. Although keep in mind, Charlemagne had to order many of those to be grown. So why is this cuisine so simple? Well, it's the trade routes. They're really not working anymore. There are no spices coming from the east. There's no time to sit and develop a sophisticated cuisine. And a very small group of nobles, right? And everyone else basically are serfs. There's no middling classes. There's no social mobility at all. Let alone the fact that the wealthiest people are usually out on campaigns fighting, right? So they don't have time to sit and cultivate taste. But even when they get home to their isolated castles, what do these guys do? They spend their time hunting. In fact, they're the only ones eventually allowed to take big game. So no one can really imitate what they eat. And what are they going to spend their money on? Nothing. There's really nothing to buy. All they can do is hoard this money or melt it down for gold jewelry. In fact, Frankish jewelry is magnificent stuff. Charlemagne's court is really just one bright spot on an otherwise bleak several hundred years in Western Europe. After his death, the empire was divided up among heirs, each smaller kingdom struggling but never quite as powerful. And recurrent famines, continued depopulation, more invasions by a new set of barbarians, these are the Vikings, meant that Europe didn't even begin to get back on its feet until about the year 1000, and that's when things really begin to change. But one other thing, let me briefly describe the Byzantine Empire, because classical culture, in particular science, agriculture, medicine, really survives there through this period. And it's through the Byzantines that these arts and sciences pass on to Islam. The most obvious examples are in dietary medicine, authors like Aetius of Amida, Oribazius, Paul of Aegina, who commented upon and revised the work of Galen. And it's through their writings that medieval Islam inherits the Western tradition. And likewise, another fascinating text, the Geoponica, compiled in Constantinople in the 10th century and widely translated into other languages, records many ancient food technologies such as winemaking, horticulture, breeding cattle, how to salt meat, and of course the surviving recipes for how to make garum are in that book. So in a very real sense, the Byzantine Empire provides the bridge between the ancient world and medieval Islam, which sweeps over much of the Eastern Empire, and finally Constantinople itself in 1453. But it's to this Islamic world that we turn next.
Thanks for listening to episode 11 of Food, a Cultural Culinary History. Just a reminder, if you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Kenal Bala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts. Featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from Western civilization, computer programming, psychology, conflict management, mind-body medicine, you name it, at The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.